This is Kurt Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
Hello, this is Sandra Shelton.
Hello, Tom Haynes is my name.
Hi, I'm Joyce Davis.
Hi, I'm Tara Smith.
Vengeance, a California ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. When the samurai warrior Kane first came to California from Tokyo, he brought his new wife, the beautiful Ishi. She was an ideal wife, gentle, attentive, and a wonderful cook. Kane was the envy of his new neighbors, but he was a proud man. When a wealthy family moved into the neighborhood, Kane cast his eye upon their lovely daughter, Aiko, and desired her. In his mind, Ishi was second best, so Kane plotted to rid himself of his wife so he could woo and win the fair Aiko. On a stormy night, on the way home from a great banquet, Kane pushed Ishi over the cliff and into the bay. No one heard her scream. No one suspected foul play when Kane came rushing back to the banquet hall, shouting for help because his poor wife had slipped and fallen over the cliff. Kane acted the part of the bereaved husband to perfection. He gave Ishi a splendid funeral. It wasn't until he was alone in his house that Kane relaxed and drank to his success. Outside, the wind whipped against the house, making the walls rattle and shake. A stray breeze swept through the sleeping room with a whisper. Vengeance. Vengeance. Kane sat up and blinked as a dark figure stepped into the room. Its long, tangled black hair hung over the dirty, blood-stained kimono. Its face was crushed and broken, with one eyeball hanging from the socket. The ghost of Ishi reached out a broken hand toward her husband, smiling through the shattered remaining teeth. Vengeance, she whispered. Vengeance. Kane screamed in terror, leapt out of the window, and ran to a neighbor's house. Mistaking his fear for grief, the neighbors took him in and insisted he stayed with them during the first few weeks of his bereavement. A month passed as Kane waited for Ishi's ghost to reappear, but she vanished. Relieved, Kane decided it was safe to bring Aiko and her family to see his home. As he escorted Aiko's parents around the garden, he felt a hand on his arm. Kane turned around and found himself facing a beautiful Ishi, who kissed him and whispered in his ear, Vengeance. Laughing, Ishi danced away, waving to Aiko and her parents as she passed. Aiko glared after her in jealous rage. Fearing that Aiko might end the betrothal, Kane pressed forward with his suit, arranging for a grand engagement feast to prove his devotion. Friends, neighbors, and family came to the banquet hall to laugh and toast over food and wine. Kane was very pleased with his success, but when he looked across the hall, he saw the ghost of beautiful young Ishi walk into the room and stand demurely in the corner. He paused mid-sentence and stared in horror as she laughed and began to change. Her body twisted and broke before Kane's eyes, her face collapsing inward and bleeding, her black hair tangling, her eyeball popping out of its socket. Vengeance, she whispered. No! No! Kane shouted. Around him, Aiko, her parents, and the guests stared. None of them could see the ghost. As Ishi drifted out of the door, Kane followed, vowing she would haunt him no more. The ghost drifted along the cliff path with Kane running after her, shouting and cursing. Suddenly, the ghost stopped at the place where Kane had pushed her. She turned to face Kane and started to growl, her crushed body bloody and dirty, her eyeball swaying, her shattered teeth gleaming in the moonlight. Vengeance! She screamed, and lunged at Kane. The samurai stepped backward, face contorting in fear. His foot slipped suddenly on the loose earth, and he plunged backward over the edge of the cliff, his body fatally smashing into the rock far below. That same night, a terrible storm beat against Kane's house. Lightning hit the roof, and the house burned to the ground. Neighbors claimed they could hear a voice in the wind saying one word over and over. Vengeance. 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 Vengeance.
Roadwork by Walt Hicks. Howard sat beneath an I-95 overpass to get out of the heat. It would be preferable if he wasn't seen anyway, considering that he was still smoldering. Eyes heat exploded from the now empty sockets awaiting regeneration. Clothing that was not burned away melted to his blackened flesh. He rested his chin in his cupped left hand, and annoyingly, skin flaked off and fell to the concrete. He poked his cooked tongue back through the hole in his neck. His nose was gone, but unfortunately he could still smell the acrid stench of his own burned flesh. The authorities would eventually find the Chevy Suburban, a crumpled mass, burned to a shell just off the interstate where Howard had left it. They would be curious why the driver's seat was vacant, but the tragedy of the fiery death of the family of six would override any in-depth investigation into what was surely another bloody 95 accident. Howard always hid close by because he enjoyed watching, when his eyeballs came back, the paramedics retrieved corpses from wrecks. Howard had always been a motorhead, working for the wrecker service during the day, tearing down and rebuilding racing engines at night, then running them nearly to the red line at weekend stock car races. Howard had been something of a local driving legend in the small Florida town just off Interstate 95 near Jacksonville, a driving legend, among other things. Born with neither conscience nor a sense of compassion, Howard was perfect for his wrecker driving job. He could retrieve broken bodies, male, female, child, from the most horrifically twisted wreck and miss neither a meal nor a moment's sleep. He amazed and quite frankly worried the local paramedics, most of whom could not stomach pulling a dead baby from a crushed vehicle. Although it was predominantly their responsibility, they gladly allowed Howard the grim privilege of recovering the mangled bodies from crashes. It had been rumored, although it was not quite true, that Howard had removed a decapitated prom queen from her flipped Mustang convertible with a Butterfinger candy bar clamped between his teeth. Actually, it had been a Mr. Goodbar. Howard went quickly through three marriages, never physically or emotionally abusing his wives. He merely frightened them away. "What was I thinking? God, did he ever creep me out?" Mildred Connolly, his second wife, would whisper, shivering at the thought. "It was like being touched by a walking, breathing corpse." Not that Howard cared either way. He had always been a loner, and if cornered, would have admitted that he preferred the company of those he pulled from wrecks to most living, breathing people. At least they're quiet, he would allow. Everything changed one early Sunday morning. Howard had won the Saturday night feature at the local dirt track and was celebrating alone at his dilapidated mobile home near the junkyard, stomping rats to death on his back porch when the call came in. He wasn't really on duty, but the dispatcher mentioned that it was a really bad one out on I-95, and Howard's ears pricked up and the hair on the back of his neck stood on end. The nearest emotion to pleasure that Howard knew was going to an accident scene. He keyed the mic on his base station in the kitchen, acknowledging that he would take the call. Howard jumped into his ancient primer black Ford wrecker and sped toward the mile marker. Howard arrived at the scene, as usual, before almost anyone else. Deputy Roberta Burns sat near the back bumper of her county squad car, having first set up roadside flares, blocking off the highway, then upchucking all of her dinner and then some. Howard grunted, and Burns jerked a thumb over her shoulder toward the wreckage. Grinning, Howard flipped on a penlight and headed for the crash. At first, he couldn't tell what it had been. The front and rear tires were only a foot or so apart, and the metal was tangled around a bridge abutment in a perverse lover's embrace, where the vehicle had struck at terminal velocity or better. Unstoppable force meets immovable object. The gas tank had exploded with a brief but violent flash, the entire tank of fuel going up in a pluming fireball that blackened nearly the entire south side of the bridge from top to bottom. The vortex created by the force of the impact had actually put the fire out almost immediately. The front and rear seats had for all practical purposes melted, and Howard could see no bodies inside. There was a wide smear of dark blood on the bridge abutments, so Howard surmised correctly that the unfortunate driver had been ejected through the windshield and had bounced hard off the concrete. Howard looked at the rear of the wreck and saw Broadmoor Lincoln on a plastic advertising plate hanging from the trunk lid. Good. Rich prick. He started searching along the deserted highway for the sure-to-be mangled corpse. He thought he could smell the coppery, sickly sweet scent of blood on the thick, humid night air. He followed a swath of blood and tissue on the asphalt nearly 100 feet long. The body, expected to be where the grim skid mark ended, was not there. Howard had neither the intelligence nor the compassion to be frightened. No fear, read one of the many decals on his wrecker, after all. But he was bewildered. His mouth had actually been watering to see what was left of the corpse, but now there was a metallic acid taste on his palate. He didn't realize it, but he had been gnawing his tongue. From the darkness to his right, somebody cleared a throat. It sounded all wrong, as if someone were trying to rid their throat of the annoyance of their own clattering teeth. Howard whirled, shining the penlight in the direction of the sound. A dark form sat on the guardrail beneath the overpass. At first glance, Howard thought the figure's right leg was crossed informally over the left, but further investigation revealed that the legs were actually twisted around one another as if the pelvis had been snapped in half, and the left leg was bent at an impossible angle over the right. He moved the penlight's beam slowly up the bloody, twisted, tattered form until it reached what was formerly a face. Howard's hearing perception was actually quite accurate. The thing's teeth were lodged in what used to be its throat. One eye was missing, the other dangling from the optic nerve, bobbing merrily on the exposed cheekbone, most of the face having been scraped off onto the highway in a grisly 100-foot slide. A laugh erupted from the throat, and the teeth clacked together. For the first time in his existence, Howard felt the cold rush of fear slash through his spine and grip his heart with icy fingers. Curiously, he enjoyed the feeling. Howard stepped closer. "Greetings," the thing said. "Thank Christ I finally found you." Howard found himself giggling at the mutilated speech of the thing whose tongue was flapping somewhere between its larynx and esophageal opening. "How the hell can you possibly be alive?" Howard asked, genuinely fascinated. "I'm not, really," it said flatly. "Got a smoke?" Howard fumbled for the pack of Marlboros in his shirt pocket. He popped out a smoke and offered it to his newfound acquaintance. It lifted a ragged stump from which shattered bone peeked through shredded flesh. The other arm was twisted around the wrong way at the shoulder, equally useless. Howard shrugged, lit the cigarette himself, and after taking a long, luxurious drag, poked it into a rasping hole in the thing's neck. The abnormally shaped chest rose and fell contentedly. Wisp of smoke oozed through numerous holes in the mangled chest, as well as through several unnatural openings in the misshapen skull, including an exposed ear canal. Howard couldn't help laughing. "What the hell are you, anyway?" Howard inquired, taking the cigarette away, absently jamming it between his lips. "What do you think? The Grim Reaper presides over every single death? I'm with the DMV, Death by Motor Vehicle. No long lines, no waiting." The thing was gesturing animatedly with a ragged stump until it fell off at the shoulder, hitting the pavement with a greasy splat. "I was a lot like you, Howard. Didn't give a flip for nothing. I managed to kill myself 40 years ago driving stone drunk in my 57 Chevy. Also killed a family of five in the DeSoto station wagon. Ended up doing this shit for 40 years. It was fun at first, but you know what? It gets old. You do get to drive all kinds of different cars and trucks, though. You can be creative about the way you do your business. Make it as messy as you like and do it to whoever you want as long as you make the quota. There's no rhyme or reason. I always liked that part." Howard was slack-jawed in wonder. He was also feeling the vague stirrings of an erection and thought for a moment his bowels would let go. He licked his parched lips and stared at several teeth that had clattered to the pavement. "You cause car wrecks?" Howard mumbled. "More or less. Not all of them are mine. Most along this stretch of highway. We have our assigned areas. Usually work alone, although did a job with a guy in Jack's once. Remember the 30-car pile-up in the fog a couple of years back?" The thing reached around his body the wrong way with the twisted arm and scratched what was left of its forehead. Howard's dead shark eyes lit up. "And the Greyhound bus wreck? That was you?" The thing almost looked like it smiled. More teeth chattered to the asphalt. "Yeah," he said humbly. "The two Yugos and the semi, too. That was fun. Although, in the old days, we had alcohol, cigarettes, screaming kids in the back seats, and radios to distract drivers. Now, with cell phones, It's almost too easy. Most of these assholes can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Howard's mouth fell open in true admiration. God damn, you are awesome. Like a fucking maestro or something. Well, I'm not going to miss it all that much. It's actually quite a hands-on job, and not being able to die can be a real pain in the ass. Waited a long time for the right guy to come along. What I'm trying to say, Howard, the thing shambled to its feet with great difficulty. It lunged for Howard, slapping its contorted arm across his shoulder. Is your it? The thing slid wetly across Howard's body, then to his feet in a blood-soaked, wadded-up mess of ruined flesh and protruding shattered bone. When the paramedics arrived, they found the DOA and Howard's wrecker, but no Howard. Several days later, the old Ford wrecker vanished from its impound yard as well. The ominous flat black wrecker has been sighted from time to time along a certain stretch of Interstate 95 just south of Jacksonville, usually around the time of a fatal car crash. The accident fatality rate along that 15 miles of 95 is, unaccountably, nearly twice the state average. A handful of people familiar with the events occurring the night Howard disappeared faithfully avoid that bloody, eerie length of highway at any and all cost. They are understandably uneasy in the knowledge that Howard is still on the job.
And now Joyce will share Ghost Light, as retold by S.E. Schlosser.
I thought the kids would get a big kick out of it when I suggested we stop on the way to the seashore to watch for the Mako Light. After all, kids like spooky stuff. But they were dubious about the proposition, and my wife, Amanda, was downright skeptical. "Why do you want to watch for some old ghost light?" she complained. "I thought you didn't believe in that stuff." "I'm a skeptic." "Seeing is believing," I replied. The kids chimed in then. My daughter Lily was eager to see the ghost light, but Kevin Jr. just wanted to get to the beach. "We won't get there till after dark anyway. You won't be able to go to the beach until tomorrow," I said firmly. And that was that. Kev rolled his eyes expressively at my authoritarian manner and then subsided into a sulk in the back seat. Teenagers. When I complained to my own father about my teenager, he laughed at me and told me my mother had wished him on me. Apparently, I was just the same when I was a kid. It was dusk by the time we neared our destination. I switched on the car headlights and turned down the road toward Mako. To get the kids in the mood, I told them the story of the Mako Light in my best spooky manner. "There was once a railroad conductor named Joe Baldwin who was working for the newly rebuilt Atlantic Coastline. The year was 1867, and the railroad had expanded to include a small station in Mako, North Carolina. Joe was assigned to the very last car in the train, and he executed his conductor duties to the best of his ability aboard his assigned car. Then one night, something went wrong. Terribly wrong. The train was heading down the line toward the tiny Mako station when Joe's car started to slow down dramatically. Worried, Joe went forward to see what was happening, and he realized that his car had become decoupled from the rest of the train. Joe's heart leapt into his throat when he saw the retreating lights of the train disappearing into the distance. His car was stuck on the tracks, and another train was following close behind them. With a shout of dismay, Joe grabbed his signal lantern and frantically ran the length of the car. Bursting out of the back door, he ran out onto the rear platform. Yes, he could see the next train speeding toward them down the track. By the look of it, the engineer had not realized the danger. Joe leaned over the rail, desperately signaling for the engineer in the following train to stop. But the train barreled forward, its speed unabated. Joe realized that the engineer must not have seen his signal light, or perhaps had not realized its significance. He kept waving the lantern frantically from side to side, shouting in vain over the huge rumbling force of the oncoming train. The engine grew larger and larger, and Joe's heart was in his throat as he realized the train was not going to stop. With a thunderous roar and the great shriek of massive metal hitting massive metal, the engine struck the helpless car. Joe, still at his post, was smashed between the two trains. His head was severed from his body. The signal lantern flew wildly out of his hand, rolling along beside the tangled metal of the two trains and miraculously flipping upright, still alight. Joe was the only fatality in the railway accident that night. The railroad officials never located his head. Shortly after the train accident, the Mako light began to appear on the tracks near the station. People traveling on the train or crossing the tracks at Mako would report a light shining in the distance when no train was due. The light would appear as a small ball far down the tracks and then would come closer and closer to the observer until it was the size of a lantern. People reported that the light moved back and forth frantically as if it were signaling a train to stop, just as Joe Baldwin had done the night of the accident. The phenomenon became so common that the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad ordered their engineers not to stop for the light if they saw it as they were approaching Mako. Folks believed it was the spirit of Joe, the conductor, desperately replaying his final moments over and over again, trying to get the following train to stop before it hit his helpless car. As I finished the story, Kevin Jr. gave an annoying and rather dramatic sigh and said, "Boring." I ignored him and turned into the pull-off beside the railroad tracks. It was a dark night, and it got even darker as I shut down the engine and turned off the light. My teacher said President Grover Cleveland saw the Mako light once in 1889 when he was riding the train, Lily piped up from the back seat. "That's right," I said enthusiastically, tossing her a happy smile over my shoulder. We were the only ones at the pull-off that night. The moon had already set, and it was very dark. There were no vehicles passing on the lonesome highway, and all I could hear were the swish of the wind and the rattle, buzz, chirp, and bump of night creatures in the woods. I leaned back in my seat and waited, watching the faint glimmer of the railroad tracks in the starlight. "This is boring," said Kevin, after 10 minutes of silence. "Then take a nap," I suggested. 10 more minutes passed. An owl hooted back in the woods, and Lily jumped. "What was that?" she whispered. Kevin laughed at her. "It's just a boring owl," he said. 10 more minutes went by. "Honey, that dratted light is not going to show itself tonight," Amanda said. "Let's go." And then a small dot of white light appeared far down the railroad tracks. My chest tightened in excitement, and my heart started to pound against my ribs. "Look at that, look," I said hoarsely, pointing. Everyone looked, even Kevin. "It's just someone with a flashlight," Kevin said a bit uncertainly after a moment. We ignored him, breathlessly watching as the light moved slowly forward, getting larger and brighter as it approached. At first, I was excited to see it, and then goosebumps raised on my skin, and I began to feel a bit, well, creepy. There was something disconcerting about a light with no source coming closer, closer. Nothing was behind it, or above it, or below it, to explain why it was there. Nothing at all. At least, nothing I could see. I could feel my whole body trembling. Beside me, Amanda gripped my arm so hard it hurt. "Make it stop, Daddy. Make it stop," Lily whimpered from the back seat. The light hovered at man height above the ground and was now the size of a lantern. Then it started frantically moving from side to side as if it were signaling, and no one was holding it. No one at all. My heart was hammering so heavily that it actually hurt my chest, and my throat felt so tight that I could not make a sound. Even my legs started to shake, and for a moment it looked as if the light would come right into the car with us. I was reaching trembling hands for the keys when the light vanished abruptly, just a few feet from our car. Everyone gasped in fear and relief. Amanda loosened her grip on my arm. Where did it go? Lily asked at the same moment that Kevin said, Mako ghost light, that was cool. Can we do it again? I cleared my throat a couple of times. I think once is enough for tonight, I managed to say in a voice that sounded a few pitches too high. Once is enough forever, Amanda muttered. Let's go to the hotel, I said in a more normal tone as I turned the car and backed out onto the highway. I needed to see people milling about, streetlights that had a source, and the other trappings of normal society. The sight of that bodiless light floating toward me would haunt my dreams for quite a while, and I was not sure I wanted to see it again. Like Amanda said, some things you do only once.
A Christmas Gift, the Florida Folktale, retold by S.C. Slosser. Away down south, an old custom dictates that if someone comes up to you on Christmas Day and says Christmas gift before y'all do, why, y'all are obliged to give that person a present. Mind you, the custom does not say what sort of present y'all should give. But those of us who hail from the south consider ourselves to be gentlefolk. The gifts given and received in this manner are good enough to keep the custom alive and well. Now, this is not to say that this custom does not have its drawbacks. Why, the devil himself got a hold of the eastern coast of Florida in this manner. The devil, being a canny fella, knew that God was walking about Florida one Christmas day, so he hid himself behind a stump. When the Lord came strolling by, the devil jumped out real fast and said, Christmas gift! And the Lord, being as fine a southern gentleman as you could meet, held up his end of the custom and told the devil, you can have the East Coast, and continued his stroll. So now the devil plays hurricane games with the East Coast of Florida whenever it pleases him.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.